UK Wine Show, show number 8. G'day, and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott. This week we're going to start a series of 3 interviews looking at wines in the restaurant trade. To start off with, we've got James Ellis. He's an owner and director of Ellis Wines. Ellis supply wines exclusively to the restaurant trade. He's going to be talking a wee bit about the history of wines in the UK restaurant, spanning over 100 years. He'll also give us some top tips about the wines that are currently trendy in restaurants, and also what to look for in a wine list on a restaurant. Next week, we've got Matthew Cooper, who is the wine buyer at Ellis. He's going to be talking a wee bit about buying wines and the sort of things that you look for when purchasing wines for restaurants. And in the following week, we're going to Marcus Tavern, which is a restaurant, and just having a look at, from their point of view, what's going on. But before we get into that, I just wanted to mention, we've now got our website up. The UK Wine Show is hosted on 3050's website, because 3050 is the sponsor for the UK Wine Show. 3050 is a wine tasting company for private and corporate events. Do have a look at the website. But we've set up our own website now called ukwineshow.co.uk. Or if you'd like to send me an email, any feedback about the show, always interested to get it. My email address is chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. I'd be more than happy to hear any feedback or any ideas you'd like to see in the show. The other thing to touch on is the wine news. We publish about 3 news articles a week. If you're interested in finding out what's going on in the news, you can either listen to the news on the podcast, or if you'd rather, you can go straight to the news page. That's off the ukwineshow.co.uk's website. Before we get into the interview with James, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the continuing debate about what is the best way to seal our bottles of wine, a recent report has found that as drinkers we want 3 things from our closures, the most important of which is that they're easy to open. According to the Global Wine Closure Report, our requirements come down to simplicity, it's easy to open, followed by security, it seals properly, and sincerity, assurance for us that the wine won't be corked. The survey of more than 1,000 people across 55 countries also found that screw cap stood out as the most reliable closure and were thought by New World respondents to overtake natural cork as the favoured closure of the future. Another study published in the United States by the National Academy of Sciences predicts an increase in the frequency of extremely hot days could threaten premium wine growing in the US by the end of the century. The study, based on computer-generated climate projection, suggests that California, which grows nearly 90% of America's wine grapes, could face serious losses of production as a result of future climate change. Areas most likely to be affected are Napa Valley, Sonoma Valley, and Santa Barbara. But back here in Britain, the global warming cloud continues to bring something of a silver lining. There's a much better chance of us growing grapes successfully, as far north as Yorkshire. In fact, from a single vineyard last year, Yorkshire now has 4 wineries looking for grape success. And finally, ask someone what they think their wine smells of, and odds on they might say something different from you. That's because wine aromas aren't the same for everyone, and are possibly as unique to each person as a fingerprint. The Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia is an organization devoted to taste and smell. While humans only have a few hundred stimuli for taste, they can distinguish thousands of different smells, and apparently some people cannot detect certain smells at all. Musk, for example, is a difficult one to detect. Other wine aromas which are commonly difficult to detect include bananas, pears, and floral scents. So now you can be brave when asked to describe a wine, because whatever you say, no one can say you're wrong. And that's all for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Jane. I thought that was quite interesting, particularly about the wine industry picking the screw cap as the closure for the future. Another item of news that I saw recently was that the WWF, the World Wildlife Foundation, was trying to say that we should be using more corks to protect the oak trees that produce the corks. My view is, though, that if the product produces a lot of faulty wines, as the current corks do, or the process may not be cost-effective, such as the new Diam process, which removes the cork taint that you get, it may be that screw caps are the solution. As someone once said to me, if they'd invented wine now, there is no way they would have thought about putting a bit of dead wood to seal it. So we'll see how the future goes. Next up, we've got James Ellis. Let's have a listen to that. Hi, I'm here with James Ellis. He's the owner-director of Ellis of Richmond, one of London's leading restaurant wine suppliers. How are you, James?
I'm in good form, thank you.
Excellent. I think one of the things I'd like to do is perhaps start with just a wee bit of history about Alice. We were talking earlier, and it was quite interesting because it gave quite an overview of the wine trade in London and the UK as well. When did Alice first start?
Alice Richmond was established in 1822, nearly 200 years ago, as a city wine merchant based in the city of London, and moved to Richmond in the early part of the 1900s. And established itself and built up a chain of retail stores into the 70s, by which time the family decided that owning retail stores was perhaps into the future had some problems.
What was the reason for that?
The recessions of the 70s, and also the arrival of the supermarkets, who yep. were beginning to start to look at wine retailing. And it was decided to sell the wine stores and concentrate on distribution and representation of wineries from across the globe and specialising into the restaurant trade.
So how did you get into the current on-trade side of the business?
Having sold the shops in the late 70s, we bought a garage in the back of St Margaret's in between Twickenham and Richmond, and we started with six of us, including van drivers and office staff, and we looked for a new market.
Yeah.
And that's where we've arrived from that over the last 20-something years.
So why are you called Alice of Richmond?
Because we moved into Richmond in 1903.
You guys used to have big caves under Richmond, is that right?
Correct, all under the cellars, all below, all bar one, and all down to the river. Underneath all those buildings in there is all originally underground cellars, which is where we were based from the early 1910, say, until about 1974.
And now you're out here near Twickenham,
yep.
where we're based, and you've got a nice big flash warehouse.
Big shed, we call it, full of pallets of wine, and it's a bonded warehouse. So we import everything directly from all our suppliers all over the world.
Bonded means that Gordon Brown doesn't get his duty.
He does not get his duty until we clear the wine.
That's a shame.
We're happy about that.
Okay, so you guys focus in on the restaurant trade. What's going on in the restaurant trade at the moment?
I think the restaurant trade, I'm sure everybody knows, has been quite a buoyant market, particularly during the last 5 to 10 years. There's lots and lots of restaurants opened up. It's been a very exciting time. I think there's been lots of change in consumer tastes, both from a food point of view and also from the wines that people are enjoying in the restaurants.
And what sort of varieties, or is it varietal-led, or is it, you know, the new world, old world?
Plainly, in the last 10 years, the new world has really arrived on the scene. When we started the business, we were 95% of what we were selling was French wine, a little bit of Spanish and Italian, lots of German. But during the last 10 years particularly, it's become very much more new world focused and varietal driven.
Okay, and you've got some agency lists as well. An agency list just for people.
That's where we would represent a supplier for his UK interests. And this would be a producer, whether he be in Chile or New Zealand, or maybe a grower in Chablis or a grower in Bordeaux.
Yeah.
And we would represent their interests into the UK market.
So you take these wines in, they come into your bonded warehouse. Then as the sales come in from the restaurants, you deliver the wine to the restaurants.
We do, yep, that's absolutely correct.
Then you bill them about a month later.
Well, hopefully, and then they pay, yeah.
Are they good payers?
They're pretty good, yeah. Generally, yeah. I think we've got some super customers, yeah.
I've heard the restaurants can be a bit notorious about not paying their bills.
Some are better than others, let's put it that way.
Okay. We were just touching on earlier a bit about some of the trendy varieties. You know, you mentioned things like the Spanish grape Albarino. What other sort of things are you seeing in there?
I think what we've seen, particularly in the last 5 years, has been that the what we call the aromatics, the drier, more fruit-driven styles of wine have become much more popular, much more fashionable. In the early days, it was a lot of the big, rich, oaky Chardonnays were coming in from the New World, particularly from Australia. That helped to establish the New World credentials into the market. But in the last 5 years, we've seen Pinot Gris, Riesling is still hard, but yeah. It's beginning to come a bit more successfully. Certainly Sauvignon Blancs, obviously everybody, these are very fashionable at the moment.
How have you found, from your point of view, the change in dynamics? You know, Australia was, or still is, probably the dominant supplier into the UK at the moment from a country's point of view. What other, are they still there from a restaurant point of view as opposed to what's been sold in the supermarkets?
Yeah. I think what we've seen is that Australia was very, very successful for a number of years, but I think a lot of people drank a lot of Australia, perhaps dining out or at home with friends. And we've started to see that Australia, particularly at the entry point level, the cheaper end wines, perhaps have they delivered enough value for money, being quite brand driven. And we've started to see that some new countries are really beginning to succeed well in the on-trade, particularly South Africa, particularly New Zealand. I think they've really come up. And also Italy's become very fashionable. Yes, we all know the success of Pinot Grigio, and that has definitely helped Italy get itself quite well established in the restaurants. But people are now starting to drink a lot more of the esoteric and more indigenous grape varietals from Italy. And we're seeing that as a real booming market.
I was reading in one of the wine journals recently that Italy is starting to grow its export markets again, which is brilliant to hear.
Yeah, no, really good. And I'm excited with Italy. It's an interesting area to buy from. There's some great wine. Some of it, the top stuff, is very expensive, but really can be exceptionally good. Yeah. But lower end and mid price, really some super wines. You've just got to be adventurous, be prepared to select wines maybe that you can't even say the name of. But certainly there's some really, really good stuff.
There. Excellent. If you're in a restaurant, you know, if I'm sitting in a restaurant having a meal, is there any signs that I can see that might give me an indication that the restaurant takes their wines quite seriously?
I think there are certainly a couple of really good pointers is the range of wines by the glass. I think if you've got a serious restaurant and you've got some ideas about what you're trying to achieve with it, with your food and your delivery of wine, I certainly think a range of wines by the glass. When we started in the late 70s, early 80s, the standard for a restaurant was one red, one white.
Yep.
A few years later, we persuaded people, with the arrival of the New World, to add on an Australian red and white or Chilean red and white onto what was normally a French red and white.
Yep.
Particularly during the last 10 years and maybe even the last six, there's been a huge change in restaurant, good restaurateurs' attitudes to serving wine by the glass. We now would see a lot of restaurants doing a minimum of six red, six white, maybe even up to 10 red, 10 white by
the
glass.
Gosh, that's quite serious.
And certainly a couple of rosés, which are very in fashion at the moment.
Yeah, dead trendy.
Dead trendy. And certainly that has made, from a consumer's point of view in the restaurants, a much wider choice. It makes the offer from the restaurant much more interesting. And certainly what we're beginning to see is that it's not just all Chardonnay and all Sauvignon Blanc and all Cabernet Sauvignon and all Shiraz.
Yep.
The range of wines offered by the glass is increasingly becoming more eclectic. Yep. And that's very exciting for the wine trade.
Do you think it's because people will be able to then match the wine to their food? Is that the driver there, or is it more about everybody having the glass they prefer?
I think it's a mix of both. From a personal point of view, our trade talks a lot about food and wine. There are certain schools of thought that say this is really a very important part of the offer of wine and why it's become much more exciting. I personally am more a believer that it's actually the variety of choice. You're out with your partner, your girlfriend, your wife. You want to drink a rosé, but she wants to drink a dry white. The restaurant now gives you that choice. And also it's a way in which you can taste something before you go and eat. And if you've had a glass of something perhaps a little more interesting that you're prepared to take a glass of, you might say, gosh, that's great, we'll have that, we'll have a bottle when we sit down and eat.
What about wine pricing? I often, when I'm running a tasting, if people want to get an idea of the pricing of wine, I normally say, have a look on the list, see if you can find a Chablis on the list, because in the high street, Chablis 10 quid a bottle, sometimes 9, sometimes 11, but £10, and then you look it up on the restaurant, and if they're selling it for £25, then that gives you an idea of their markup. What sort of markups do people have in the trade?
I think you've hit on quite an interesting point. We would hope to see a £10 Chablis from a retail point of view fit at around the £25 mark. I think it depends on the business. If you're a wine bar driven type of, you know, selling lots of wine by the glasses without perhaps the silver service and the white tablecloth, then it might be 20, 22, 25, and then perhaps up to 28, 28 to 30. And obviously, if you head into central London to the really trendy, fashionable restaurants, you know, you might expect to pay between 30 and 40. But one thing is for sure, that I think the quality, just taking Chablis or maybe even Sancerre or a New Zealand Sauvignon, the wines that are generally now destined for the independent restaurateurs and the specialist restaurants are really driven by quality. So you mustn't be scared to see a £25 or a £28 bottle of wine in the restaurant and assume that they've bought it as a £4.99 or £5.99 wine in the supermarkets.
Yep.
Because the truth is that's not what's going on.
If you were to make a recommendation to people for them to try a different glass, or is there anything that you'd recommend people give it a go if they haven't tried before?
Yeah, New Zealand Pinot Pinots.
Yeah,
New Zealand Pinot Noir. I think they're certainly not cheap.
Certainly not cheap. Especially the ones I drink.
Value for money. Yeah. I think it offers one of the great wines. You know, if you want to really excite yourself and find something interesting, get yourself a good bottle of Pinot Noir from New Zealand. Absolutely fantastic.
Not cheap, but good value.
Fantastic value.
And just one last thing before we head off. We always ask to get a wine tip. Do you have a tip for us today?
I do. I can find you a tip. One of the tips I often say to friends of mine who are sitting down around a dinner table or with friends, they say to me, James, if I'm in the supermarkets and I'm looking for a bottle of wine, what would I do? And I say a good tip would be look for a wine that you know. Find it, see it at whatever price it might be. Yep. Look left, look right. Find something for the same money that you've never heard of,
yep.
Because there you're getting fantastic value.
What's driving that? Is it because they're spending a lot of money? If you know the wine, then they're obviously spending some money to tell you about it, marketing the wine to you.
Yeah, definitely. I think the bigger brands, particularly in retail, you know, there is a huge element of that price that is from their marketing side. Yes, they are. In critical volume point of view, they're producing in very, very big volumes.
So they're getting economies of scale.
They're definitely getting economies of scale. But I still think that if you want to excite yourself and learn a bit more about wine, just taking the standard same old brand that you buy at $4.99 and not perhaps looking a little broader, because when you find a wine at $4.99 or $5.99 on something you don't know, trust me, I think you'll be quite surprised. There's some really good stuff there.
Well, thanks very much, James.
Yeah, been a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with James Ellis. I thought there were some pretty interesting things there about what to look out for in a restaurant, particularly the wines by the glass. I think that's quite a good tip. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Matthew Cooper. He's the wine buyer at Ellis. He's going to give us some ideas from his point of view. Until then, cheers. And good drinking.